just great to have so many people turn out for our volunteer reception on a Saturday, beautiful Saturday morning in the summer. This was a risk. But we wanted to do something very special for our volunteers. And if you remember last year's event, which was a glorious kind of cocktail party on the top of the Biomedical Sciences building, the staff had a hard time coming up with something to top that. And then when we figured that we could actually dovetail on John Scott's visit here and have this meeting with him to see his new piece that's on the first floor of the library, you passed it as you came in, this all sort of fell into place. And we thought, because so many of our volunteers are our docents who see John's large piece in the museum every time they come, and it's become a real favorite in the collection, that this all would work together. So we're just tickled that it did. And from the bottom of our hearts, all of the staff, we really thank you, our volunteers, for everything that you do for us. From the Friends Board, to the Twilight Committee, the docents, the house tour, all of the other events that we have. There are members of the Museum Advisory Committee here as well, and other colleagues from across the university who work with the staff during the year. I don't have a total of numbers, although Julie can tell me how many people we actually invited. About 200 volunteers, and if we toted up the hours, it would be thousands and thousands of hours of volunteer service that you provide to us. And as you know, our staff is so small, we really couldn't function without you. So this is our meager way of saying thank you for everything that you do. I have the great pleasure of introducing John Scott. Many of you have probably had a moment to greet him and to meet him already, and you certainly are familiar with his work. He's going to show us some of his slides, including some of his very recent work, which I haven't seen yet, but he described with ideas for further collaborations with us. John is an MFA graduate of the art department, as many of you know, and he's also received the Distinguished Alumni Award from the college and an honorary doctorate from the college. And Linda's correcting me. From the university, honorary doctorate from the university, excuse me. And his work is in collections all over the country. The New Orleans Museum of Art is preparing a major retrospective of his work for 2005 with over 200 pieces. And we are going to be very happy to lend our piece to it as well. He has done outdoor pieces, commissions, prints, and sculpture wall pieces, but you'll get a real idea of what he's done over time. So we're just very happy he's back on campus and would like to greet him.
Thanks, Liv. Thank you. I'll try and make this as painless as possible. Before showing the slides, I think that there are a couple of things that you should understand about my philosophy and how I work and so forth. From an idea point of view, I really think there are basically three ways that people codify information. You know, there's people that think in a linear fashion. That is, they think like a string of beads on one above the other. There are some people that process information on a planar level, that is, imagining things related on this flat surface. And over the last 40 years or so, I have tried to develop what I consider spherical thinking or jazz thinking. I'll use the jazz analogy first. If you've ever seen a really fine jazz group perform, three things are always evident. The musicians are always in the now while it's happening, with an unbelievable understanding of where they have been, which could be yesterday, history, the past. And they have an unbelievable anticipation of where they're going, hope, the future, tomorrow. And they do all three of these things at the same time. Now, another way of saying that same idea is if you can imagine all information that is, or will be as a glass globe, and you're suspended in the middle. If you look up, you understand down, because they're connected. And if you move forward, you understand backwards, because they're connected. Jazz of cerebral thinking. The other thing is that in my work, I have never believed that monumentality has anything to do with scale. You know, Japanese can put a forest on a coffee table, they just call it bonsai. So it has nothing to do with size. It has to do with the spirit, the intent. And lastly, coming out of the city of New Orleans, you know, that's one of those places where we're born with music, we live with music, and they put us on the ground with music. But music is not just about entertainment. It's a lot more than that. My work has given critics a lot of headaches for a long time, in the sense that it is two aspects of the culture. It deals with the blues, which is a narrative form. It tells a story. If we're talking about the visual arts, the blues would be quite figurative. But it also heavily depends on jazz, which is metaphorical and extremely abstract. So I work on both sides of that equation, and I don't find that a contradiction, though critics think that I'm not focused. Important thing on that as well is that in my earliest training, I was always told that media is like language, and there is nothing wrong with being linguistically proficient. You know, if I walked in this room and spoke seven languages, most of you would probably think I'm very intelligent. But if I speak more than one visual language fluently, most critics think that I'm not focused. So I don't worry about any of that stuff. That's their problem. What I thought I would do this morning is just run through some 30 or more years of stuff to give you an idea of how I've worked. My work have gone through a lot of different phases, but I think every artist that ever existed only had one thing to say. It just takes a lifetime to say it. So what you're gonna see are just a bunch of facets on my surface trying to find that one truth that I have to say at some point in time. So having said that, if I could, I'll just make this a little easier. Okay. What you're looking at now is some of the earliest work that I did. A lot of my early work was very liturgical in nature. Coming out of New Orleans, born and raised Catholic, you could easily understand the influence. The thing about monumentality, the piece that's on your right is only about 9 inches tall, of bronze. The other one is a crucifix done. When I did that crucifix, I was in one of those states where I was independently poor and could not afford welding rods. So that's done with coat hangers and acetylene torch. Okay, now we're supposed to move. Good. This is a piece done for an all-girls academy in New Orleans. It's life-size. It was modeled with welding rods and acetylene torch. This little piece is based on Icarus, a theme that I have worked with over the years, and that's only about 9 inches tall. Another Icarus form. On your right is on your right is a litho, and on the left is a welded steel piece based on the Thunderbird dance of the Native American. And the question that some people have whenever I start doing this is they say, well, who prints your prints? I do. Who do your welding? I do. You know, if it's my work, it's my work. This is a series of bronzes done in the late 60s, early 70s. A lot of my work is, according to some critics, political. I think all art is political, including everything Michelangelo did in the Vatican. If you support an idea, it's political. But these pieces were done in response to Rhodesia in South Africa. And what triggered this was one morning going to work, My wife had put some things out for Goodwill, and among those things was a baby doll. And this baby doll had intrigued me because it triggered ideas that I had heard from a lot of people. And that is that almost every ethnic group on the face of the earth says about other people, oh, they all look alike. So I took this baby doll head and I did a bunch of pieces with it, but I made sure that even though it was the same head, no two pieces would look alike. And these were a series of masks done at the same time using body parts from various friends of mine. You will see nails reoccurring in a lot of my work. It refers a lot to the notion of the crucifixion and other things. So there's a lot of symbolism in the work. And by the way, this is the second time I'm doing this stuff. Some of these images got turned around, so I'm not that great a technician. The apple piece was a part of a series that came in coming out of this thing called the Ritual of Oppression. The spaghetti eater. Gotta have a sense of humor. The boxes, the idea behind that whole series was that, you know, when we were brought here as a commodity. So I did this whole series on boxes, and they were making reference to the fact that in Africa, if it's a motherland with a rich, full breast, it was a breast at which her own children could not nurse. So inside these boxes, all these figures, if the figures are bound, the breast is free. If the breast is bound, the figures are free. But they were never together. This is wood, a series of pieces I did out of wood. I love exploring materials. The one at the bottom is a combination of a thing called a cactus collar, as well as the crown of thorns. And it was based on the notion of the slave collar that used to be put around people's neck that didn't want to really be a slave. If you took off and ran, it would break your neck. So it was based on those kinds of ideas. Wood. In 1983, something happened that changed the direction of my art and my life. I was asked to participate in designing the first African-American pavilion in the history of world fairs in New Orleans. Though W.E.B. Du Bois had done an exhibit, there had never been a pavilion, an African-American pavilion. So my first inclination was, I don't want to be a part of this. I don't want to deal with politicians. I don't like working with committees. But the friend of mine that was involved could probably sell Eskimos refrigerators. And she got me involved. And in the process of doing a lot of research, things began to happen in my work. One of the things was that in studying the Middle Passage, I started designing very large sculptures that would be designed to go across walkways and would force people to walk under them. But they would look very intimidating, as if they'd fall on you and do some serious damage. Some of these things were designed to be like 40 feet tall. And the idea was to give people the experience without ever giving them a lecture on what the experience was about. The piece on your right was one of the first kinetic ideas that I began to explore. That thing that looks like a gigantic hot dog at the top was actually to be designed as a big cylinder. And those black things you see coming off were going to actually be very thin aluminum tubing that was hooked up with springs so that when the wind blew, they would move. But when it came back, they would resonate. So this piece would sing. That was the concept. These are just some bronze pieces that I started painting. There's a very interesting story about these because there was a critic at the time that was a little bit upset about the fact that I painted bronze. And in my studio once, the guy was going into this tirade about the problem he was having with my painting bronze. And I finally said, you know, there's a real easy way to solve the problem. And he wanted to know what that was. I said, get the hell out of my studio. These were a series of pieces designed around Storyville in New Orleans, which I won't go into, but they were putting things together with knots, and they had other kinds of symbolic significance. This is the pavilion called I Have Known Rivers. So a quick aside about this pavilion. Most people that did pavilions at the World's Fair in New Orleans had a 5-year running start. When we got involved in this, we did everything you see here more in 1 year. The World's Fair was evaluated on a basis of 1 to 5. The Vatican Pavilion, the U.S. Pavilion, the Canadian Pavilions were 5s. We were four, so we didn't feel bad. One of the most significant things that happened there was in doing the research for this pavilion, I came across a lot of historical information. And at the same time, I was invited by George Rickey to become a Hand Hollow Fellow in upstate New York and go up and spend time working out of George's studio. One thing that should be really clear about that, George would invite 16 artists a year from all over the world just to come and work out of his studio. We were not students of George Rickey. We were simply colleagues that worked out of his studio. I had a long conversation with George about kinetics because I was interested in kinetics and I wanted to do it for years. But I refused to do it because I don't think you could sing somebody else's song as well as they can. And his comment was that if you're going to do it, it's going to happen. Don't worry about it. Just do what you do. Well, while working on this pavilion, I came across a piece of African mythology that said when early African hunters would kill something, there was a tremendous sense of remorse. So what the hunter would do is to take his bow and hold the wooden sections and change the tension on the strings, which was played by a companion to give a libation of sound to the soul of the animal that gave his flesh to feed the people. This idea just knocked me out. So immediately I started building bow-shaped sculptures. And what dawned on me the minute I started doing that was that any line between two points has all the attributes of wave physics. It has length, frequency, and amplitude, and if I stuck something on a line, I had a kinetic vocabulary. Now, what was even more significant is that idea is actually the marriage of African mythology and Western technology. Well, if you know anything about the blues is a marriage of African rhythms, Western harmonics. So what I had done was created a visual blues. That's what started this. And again, this thing about scale, the piece at the bottom right, the little red things you see at the top are actually toothpicks. So these are just a series of pieces. All of these pieces are kinetics based on wave physics, and they're relatively small. The one on the lower right is the first diddly bow thing that I ever did. Mother and child, kinetic. And again, these are very small pieces. They're only about 12, no bigger than 18 inches. Ritual canoe. Craftsmanship is also extremely important to me. So all of these things were crafted, regardless of their scale. On this one, for example, all the joints were made with jeweler's tools so that all the joints were very pristine and worked. Take the A-frame. Tribute to Duke Ellington's Take the A-train. This was done when the Willindas fell in Florida. It's called Air Dancer. It was done in honor of the Willinda family, the high wire walkers. But the two figures that are sitting on the wire are actually Chowaras of West African sculptural tradition. The piece at the top, the blue and the red, was a piece done in honor of all people that live in a diaspora. So what happens when the wind blows, those two things overlap and become a Star of David for a second. And then it's gone. But when they overlap, they're also the male and the female. It's the union, and it disappears. So it's just a symbolic thing. The bottom piece is St. Thomas clothesline. Came from a housing project. I like color, a lot of color in my work. But color is not just decorative in the way that I use it. It's highly symbolic. And one of the reasons I started doing that was I remember as a kid growing up in what is called the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, which is probably the equivalent of Harlem, Watts, Bed-Stuy, and those places, is that there were people that could drive through my neighborhood at 90 miles an hour and give you a dissertation as to who I was after they went through. So I decided to start using color in such a way that if you made a decision about my work from across the room, 90% of the time you're going to be wrong. Because what looks like it's three-dimensional will probably be flat, and what looks like it's flat will probably be three-dimensional. So the whole idea of the illusion of color is that you have to take your time to understand anything. So I would set up those kinds of equations in my work. Just the same piece back in front. Welded steel. All the horizontals and diagonals are kinetic, all based on the idea of the diddly bow. This is a critic once asked me to describe what these things were about. And I said, well, it's non-figurative, figurative art. because this is, two of my daughters went to ballet. And if you know any little girl into ballet for the first time, everybody does the point. So I just took that notion and did it figuratively, but only using the spirit, leaving the body out the way. The other thing is that you will notice where the bow forms have been, it's now circular. It was circular for two reasons. One was technical, for the structural strength of the thing. The other was that the diddly bow has a yang and yin existence. That is, the bow is a weapon. It can take life, but it's a musical instrument. It can create life in so many ways, so the circle. This was a piece done for an apartment in Boston. It was called Jacob's Ladder. To give you an idea of scale, that's 11 feet across. And it fit on the living room wall of this apartment. Nice apartment. two totem forms. The one on your right is called, the one on your left is called Fest Totem. And the one on the right is Frank's Totem, in honor of a friend of mine that was murdered. Palmetto, 11 feet across. All the diagonals are kinetic, they all move. Light is very important to my work, the way that shadows move, because shadows amplify the motion. Most of these pieces, when installed, and these are all indoor pieces, most of them, when they are installed in relationship to air conditioning vents or heating vents, so that you don't see the current that makes them move, but they do move. The piece that you can only see a fragment on the wall, the long wall piece, was done when Clifton Chenier, who's a very great Zydeco musician, died. The piece was called Zydeco. It's 40 feet long with 45 kinetic elements. In fact, it's nothing more than an accordion. If you break an accordion apart, it's nothing but wooden frames with bellows in the middle. So what I did was made these frames and used the kinetic elements as the bellows, so whenever it goes in motion, he plays again. Sorry about that one. And some of you will recognize this. The story behind this piece, it came out of a series called Just Another Window for the Blues. As a kid growing up in New Orleans, I think we have more churches and joints than any other city in this country. And some places, they're right next door to each other. And as a kid, we'd pass a lot of these places with this incredible music coming out, and we couldn't go in. So when we'd pass, we'd just sit on the sidewalk because it was just another window for the blues and listen to the music. So this series was reflective of that. The piece on your right is called Blues Lace for Sister Sarah. It was done when Sarah Vaughan died. And this was the theme piece, Just Another Window for the Blues. This piece was a ritual requiem for Sonny Stitt. Those horizontals are 6 feet across. Give you an idea of scale. That's all painted steel. The top piece is Muddy's Window in honor of Muddy Waters. And the bottom piece is called T-Bone in honor of T-Bone Walker, great, great blues player. Walter Steele. I love to make prints and do a lot of other stuff. I get bored very easily, so I try to do a lot of stuff, so I don't. And these were my collographs. I did this series of collographs quite a number of years ago. And the story behind it is a friend of mine in New York had asked me for a show that I forgot about. And the guy called 3 weeks before the show was due and said, when the work's coming? So in 3 weeks, I ended up doing 27 of these prints, which are quite large. Printed them, dried them, put them in a crate, sent them to New York. But they're all done with Elmer's glue and paper and sand. They look like they're etchings or aquatints, but they're actually paper, glue, and sand. These are more. My students, a lot of times I will do this stuff in class as a demonstration when teaching. And I had this one particular student that was a little bit upset with me. And the guy made a comment. He was emptying a paper punch, and he was emptying a trash can, and under his breath, he made a comment that, I suppose you use that too. Well, the stuff he threw in the trash can is the groin and the hair on the head. Collographs. These are drawings. I'm sorry about the one on the left. It's turned sideways. Excuse me. These drawings happened after my father died. My father was a cook in New Orleans, and I think if he was alive today, they would have called him a chef. But the series title was called Third World Banquet Table, because my father set a lot of banquet tables for a lot of people, but he was never invited to sit down. So these drawings were about that. These are two experimental drawings. The one on the right is in the London Museum's collection. More drawings. Most of these drawings are quite large. These are a series of gouache paintings, and the scale on these, the one on the right, is 3 by 5 inches. I was out in Pilchuck. I was invited to be a visiting artist out at Pilchuck a number of years ago. I know nothing about glass. And I asked Dale Chihuly, why would you invite people like me out here? They had a print shop there which no one was using. One day in the cafeteria, I watched this moth. I watched this moth flying back and forth against this glass, disintegrating. So I made some drawings and literally went in the print shop and made 40 prints that afternoon. And what you're looking at is those prints. It's a technique of doing wax paper monoprints off of glass. The moth. And these are rather large prints. More sculptures. These are all welded steel and aluminum. I started some years ago working with the notion of pedestrian kinetics and psychological kinetics. In studying color theory, I found that there are a lot of things color can do that creates illusion of movement when it doesn't actually move at all. It's almost like standing on a railroad platform when the train starts to move. You get this feeling that you're falling and it moves. So I did a whole series of work based on this, that if you stand in front of these things, they really have this funny feeling that they're moving. It's all based on visual mixing and optical illusions of kinetic. These are about 48 inches square. Painted aluminum. The one on your right is called Blues Window for Sidney Bechet. Those of you that know anything about jazz, Sidney Bechet was an incredible great jazz musician out of New Orleans that expatriated to Paris. Well, his nephew, his great nephew, is my studio mate, a painter named Ron Bechet. Sitting at the crossroads, it's 25 feet long. Painted aluminum. This is called Savoy Jitterbug in honor of my father. And as you look at this piece, a lot of what you think is shadow is actually paint. And a lot of what you probably think is paint is actually shadow. This was a series of collages that I did for a show at the gallery that I now show with called the Art of Roger Gallery. Each one of those collages are 4 by 8 feet. Some detail. There's a whole series done around the notion of urban warrior. I got tired of reporters calling urban hoodlums warriors. The purpose of a warrior is to protect his people. The purpose of these guys is to enrich themselves. So I did a whole tongue-in-cheek thing around that. I love the idea of collage. This is another series of the words called Urban Ibeji. And Ibeji is a twin in West Africa. I was coming back from a lecture that Ellis Marcellus and I had done in Virginia, and we were discussing gangster rap music on the plane. And my feelings were, I have 4 daughters, 3 sisters, tons of aunts, and of course a mother. And the thing about the music that disturbed me was it really devalued women in a very harsh way. And I figured if I was a woman, this stuff would make you feel like a virgin and a whore simultaneously. So So I started doing these double figures things in contradiction to themselves. That's the same piece back and front. Same piece back and front. These are maquettes for large scale works. Some I got, some I didn't get. This was one I didn't get. But it was a piece called Second Line. It was to be done by the convention center. Each one of those would have been about 15, 20 feet tall. And they're based on the Mardi Gras Indians in the city of New Orleans and the architectures. I combined both. All the things at the top were kinetic. I didn't get it. The guy that did five balls got it. This was another maquette for a piece called Funky Butt Hall. If you know anything about the city of New Orleans and its history, Buddy Bolden was credited with bringing street brass band music into dance halls. And one of the most famous dance halls where he played was called Funky Butt Hall. And Funky Butt Hall actually stood where City Hall stands today. And there's not even a piece of paper on the ground that said it ever existed. And there was an open competition, so I submitted this piece. I didn't get it. But the idea was that here's a city that based a lot of its economics on this culture, but doesn't even recognize the history of culture. But, you know, you win some, you lose some. On the left is the maquette for Street Wonders. On the right is actually the piece called Street Wonders. It's about 16 feet tall. This is a maquette for Stony Brook Dance. Stony Brook Dance, I'm sorry, in Boston. Each one of those elements is 12 feet long. They're at the Ruggles Street Station, and they're kinetic. They move as the air flows through the station. This is the National Museum of American Art Portrait Gallery. I was invited to be in a show called The Blues Migration by Rick Powell, in fact, some years ago, and decided I wanted that spot to put this piece up. And of course, most of the conservative people dealing with buildings said you can't do that because it would hurt the columns. And my idea was, if I designed a way to do it without touching the columns, can I do it? They said, that's impossible, but if you do it, you can do it. So I did. And the piece was supposed to stay up for 4 months. It stayed up for 4 years. All of those vertical elements are kinetic. And as they move, the notion of visual mixing makes the colors run back and forth that only exist in your eye. So it was kind of an interesting experiment. Tulane University School of Law. This was a piece I did some years ago about the law. Again, it's a non-figurative, figurative piece, because if you look carefully, it's actually the adversarial relationship of lawyers. It's actually two knights jousting. And the air conditioning unit above there makes these things move to make the fight happen. Xavier University's campus in New Orleans. Those rings are 13 feet in diameter. It's a piece called Ancestral Memory. No? Ancestral Legacy. I know it was one. This is a maquette for a piece called Ocean Song. This is Ocean Song. That's 16 feet tall, mirror finished stainless steel with 45 kinetic elements at the top. It's at Waldenburg Park in New Orleans. It's been through five hurricanes and it still looks like that. These are some drawings that I did while I was at Ricky's based on Gauguin's paintings. Who are we? Why are we here? Who are we? Where do we come from? Why are we here? And I was playing with the notion of what is life. And to me, it was male, female, and deity, but it's also an excuse to make a piece. This piece, which you're looking at, is more than 500 elements attached to a wall by brass spring rod. And whenever the air conditioning go on or the door would close, all these things would vibrate. And the lighting system was set up to create a one-point perspective on the wall. So when these things move, you could no longer see the wall. This was a project done for the Birmingham Museum of Art. The piece that you're about to see was done in 6 weeks from scratch, working with, I think, six college kids. The piece was 40 feet by 60 feet by 119 feet. That's the piece. What you're looking at here is 500 prisms that were suspended from the bottom of the museum that went all the way to the top. so that every day a rainbow would run across and up the building. And the whole thing was based on, excuse me, human intolerance. And the idea is that basically ignorance, things that you're ignorant of, you fear, things that you fear, you hate. But to hate anything, you have to turn it into a target to justify your hatred. So this whole piece, turn these things into targets, but when you would go around the back side, that's the back of the pieces. Everything just flattened out. So the checkerboard pattern destroyed edges. And the idea is that if you hate enough, you begin hating everything without borders. These pieces are quite large. All plasma cut steel, welded, painted. Piece was titled Rainbow Fence and Targets. This is the Philadelphia Convention Center. It's a piece called Five Rings for Philly Joe. It was a excuse me, a part of their Present for Art program. All jazz drummers have five drums set up most of the time. So I just took the notion of five rings and set them up. And it plays by the, again, circulation of air. This is 1550 in Padre Street in New Orleans. This was a Skidmore, Owen, and Merrill's building that people were not taking full advantage of. So the building owners invited in, five architects that did interiors. And one of the guys asked if I'd partner with him. Sure, why not? And we decided to redesign the space to make it attractive to people. So this is what we did. This piece is 50 feet by 35 feet by 24 feet with 76 kinetic elements. The carpet on the floor was designed to mimic the piece. And all the little tables sitting inside the chairs are mirrors. So when you look down, you saw up. Circular reasoning. Well, the space got so popular, they took the chairs and the carpet out. That's the piece. It's called Uptown Second Line. This is the gates at the New Orleans Museum of Art. Each time the gates open, it's another piece of sculpture. Excuse me. When it's completely open, it's two 13-foot tall sculpture columns, aluminum. This is the Atlanta Airport. If you come through customs in the Atlanta Airport, you'll see this piece. It exists on three different floors. So this is the first floor when you walk in. The space you're looking at in the middle is the second floor. And then there's another piece on the third, going down. As you walk under it, that's how it looks. And then this is the down piece, that's 40 feet across. And this is that second floor. Each one of those tubes are 12 feet long. Very interesting project. Everything they told me existed here didn't. So when we got ready to install this piece, nothing we had planned worked, so literally, I had to redesign the installation process while installing the piece. When my mother died in New Orleans, she had three requests. One was that she be buried in a pine box. The other was that she be buried from a horse-drawn carriage, which she was. And the third was that these young priests, who she had known most of their young religious lives, would say her mass. Well, as I explained to you early on, most of my work was liturgical in nature. But because of, I got tired of fighting visual illiteracy, I decided I wasn't doing it anymore. So all of these guys had a little secret that they didn't think I knew. They wouldn't call me to do anything, they called my mother. So at my mother's funeral mass, all this stuff is coming out like I didn't know it, right? But one of the priests said he had been trying to reach me to do a piece for his church. And I told him if he would name the pieces in honor of my mother, I'd do them for nothing. So this is the priest's chair. The back of that chair says Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But the calligraphy came from graffiti that I found on a wall in the city. So it was a way of including young people. This is the lectern and the altar. The lectern simply says word, and there are figures dancing around. This is all hand-cut plasma brass plate that's been polished. The interior is red enamel. Since the mask is actually a drummer and a dance played out with vestments and other things, the pieces are all penetrated, so as the priests move and go around these things, the reflection and the kinetics inside and the outside reflection gives this real kinetic kind of dance. This is a freebie. My sister was on a committee in New Orleans for children, and they were talking about doing a monument down by the river for kids, and they found out that was my sister. So I ended up doing this 27 feet tall piece free. It's a monument to children at play. This is the Port Authority in the city of New Orleans. This piece is both figurative and non-figurative, two and three-dimensional simultaneously. It's a celebration of the river and the history of the river. If you walk under the piece and look up, this is what you will begin to see. This is all welded aluminum painted. And as you walk back, all those three-dimensional things disappear. And what looks three-dimensional when you're looking at this thing is all trompe l'oeil. It's all illusion. So it's a contradiction in the way that you see things. The piece is 13 feet by 40 feet. The University of Houston, downtown campus, this is a piece called Prayer Meeting. And this was a funny story as well, because I'm sitting with the committee making a decision as to whether or not I'm going to get this commission. And one guy on the committee, there's always one, says, what if I told you the only way you could get this commission is that you have to change the title of this piece? The piece is called Prayer Meeting. That's what it was designed to be. And I waited a little while. I said, well, if you said that, well, that's what you wanted, I'd ask you to call me a cab. So the guy says, you mean you'd walk out of here if I just told you had to rename the piece? So you don't have that much money. You know, I got the commission. What's happening here is all of these pieces are refractory ground. If you look, you can see the pattern running across them. All of these pieces are kinetic. So as they move, there's a ribbon of light that goes back and forth across these elements. And if you look at the piece, there's three things that are evident there. One is, it's the shape of a Fong mask from West Africa, the culture out of which we came. It's also the shape of a shovel, the reason we were brought here, labor. And it's also the shape of a church fan, the spirituality that helped us to survive. So it's all three simultaneously. All aluminum. 27 feet tall. This is downtown Atlanta in Buckhead. It's a stainless steel piece, 76 kinetic elements, each 6 feet long. Mirror finished stainless steel. The base is polished black granite. In sunlight, when this thing is moving, the light just dances up the side of this building. And the thing is finished in such a way that it's total illusion. So what you're seeing on the right that looks like a building is actually the surface of the sculpture. The other thing is, as you walk past the sculpture, you become a part of the sculpture because you exist inside of it as a reflection. This is Cheekwood sculpture in a sculpture garden and botanical park. There is a walking trail there going all the way through the park. And I was asked to design a piece, so I asked, could I have the last part of the walking trail? So as you're approaching what's on your left, at the end of the trail, you have to turn and go up this hill. Well, that's what you're going to see, just those five lines up in the air. As you approach those lines, you begin to see what's on the right. And when you're facing that, you see this. So it's actually photographs of five trees that I took on site and actually cut them out. And they're perfectly flat, but I refractory ground the surface so it doesn't look flat. And if you come from the woods, you see the dark one here, so you don't see the sculpture at all. It looks like the forest itself. This is a maquette for Kansas City, 18th and Vine. It's a tribute to Charlie Parker. This is 18th and Vine. As you can see, this is very similar to Funky Butt Hall. So I just used the idea somewhere else since New Orleans didn't want it. The top of this building is a gable roof based on a 12-bar blues composition from Ellis Marsalis. So the piece itself is actually the history of 18th and Vine. All plasma cut stainless steel. This is my studio in New Orleans. And that little green thing you see is a maquette that was made out of brass with a jeweler. So a former student and I collaborated for a Percent for Art project in New Orleans. And we designed this thing called Spirit House. Well, this is us, that's me anyway, beginning to put Spirit House together. That's Martin Payton. All of those pieces you see were cut by hand individually. And what we're doing there is forming them into I-beams, flying buttresses, if you will. That's the piece. And this is the piece installed. What's unique about this piece is there are two elementary schools in this neighborhood. In fact, they're both adjacent to the site. We went into those schools and got the kids at the fourth graders to make drawings based on a lecture we did. 20 kids made drawings, but we can only use 10 drawings from each school. What you see on the on your right is the kids from the Catholic school, and on the left is the kids from the public school. That is actually their drawings cut into the piece. And what we did under this piece is we named all of these children as artists on the piece. So as long as it stands, their names are going to be there. What's interesting about this piece is it's actually a monument to a lot of unnamed, unremembered people that helped build this city. And we want to do a monument to them. It's actually a monument to an African-American labor force. So we decided, okay, what is an African-American? We decided an African-American was an African that came to America under duress. And we needed a symbol for this. So we said, okay, we'll take the shotgun house, which came into Louisiana through the Caribbean from Africa. And excuse me, when we were brought into New Orleans, Louisiana, it was Catholic and it was French and Spanish, which translated Catholic. So we decided to put a shotgun house on flying buttresses. And then we stood the flying buttresses on Egyptian columns. So that's what the piece is about. In fact, what's important about this piece is that it's historical reference. If you were to take the Black Pagoda in India, Angkor Wat, Thailand, the great Russian icons, European cathedrals, all the way down to what the Aztecs and the Incas did, all of those things had one thing in common. They were all structures that were designed for people that were visually literate, but not verbally literate. And you could literally read those things. Same thing is true here. You can literally walk around this structure and understand the history of the people in that city. These are just small maquettes for another show. The title of that show is called All of These Things. These are just small welded bronzes, only 13 inches in diameter. That gives you an idea of scale. These are just drawings. The drawing on the your left is 4 by 6 feet, just a brush drawing. The one on the right is roughly the same size. A couple of years ago, I wanted to pay homage to Louis Armstrong, whom I think is a giant out of New Orleans culture. But you cannot pay homage to a giant in small scale. So I decided to do a series of woodcuts. These are part of the series. These are the small ones. These are 40 by 60 inches. You probably won't believe it, but I'll tell you anyway. These were cut with a chainsaw. This is a drawing that is roughly 6 by 12 feet. And these are the large ones. These are 4 by 8 foot woodcuts. Done in homage to Louis Armstrong. That's his mother. And
first submitted the idea, they didn't know what I was talking about. I'm going, what? No. May 2005. Too soon. Is there a question back there? No. In fact, the black and white piece that you saw was actually a piece you saw in D.C. that had been scavenged. That piece doesn't exist anymore. No. That was recycled. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. St. Matthias. Mm-hmm. On Broad Street in the city. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Actually, one of John's student pieces is in East Lansing.
Yeah, in fact, I was going to ask Cliff if he knew where it was, because I have no slides of it.
No, was there?
Yeah, the Pietà that I did when I was a student here, somebody cast it in bronze. Yeah, it's down by the church here.
It's a church on Hagedorn.
It's a Pietà that's sitting out front. Yeah.
Edgewood,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, that piece was done the day that John Kennedy was killed. I remember I slept most of that day, and when I found out, I went to the studio that night and actually modeled that piece, because seeing John Kennedy and the wife in the lap of Jackie was the first time I understood the Pietà. Wow. So I did that piece that night, yeah.
What I didn't mention is that John is a professor at Xavier University, where he also did his undergraduate work. And I think just from the way he presented his work to us, you could see that he's a fabulous teacher. And we really appreciate your sharing your work with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's we could talk informally with John. There's more food. And yeah. Thank you all for coming. Mm-hmm.
The horses? Oh, that's how we got to Kansas City, on the back of a mule.